This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We have a number of human rights defenders in Angola that are detained unjustly, unfairly, for doing nothing. They are languishing in jail and some of them in critical condition.
That was Adriano Nuvunga, who runs the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Mozambique, urging President Joe Biden to ask tough questions about human rights issues during his visit to Angola. Details coming up. Also, in Guinea, dozens of people were killed during a stadium stampede, and drone strikes by Mali's military government killed 8 Tuareg rebel leaders. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. After promising to visit Africa 2 years ago at the U.S.-Africa Summit in Washington, President Joe Biden makes his first presidential trip to the continent, where he is visiting Angola with a quick stop in Cabo Verde. Some political analysts in Africa say the trip should have come sooner, and some are asking why Angola is the primary destination, given its troubling human rights record. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo has the report.
White House officials say President Joe Biden is looking forward to visiting the continent after a promise he made in 2022. But some analysts tell VOA that Biden's trip, which comes weeks before he steps down, would have had more weight if he had done it earlier. Lo Nell, senior political analyst for Oxford Economics Africa, spoke to VOA from South Africa.
I think his trip is less significant than it would have been otherwise, just because of the fact that he obviously withdrew as the presidential candidate, and then, of course, is now not returning for a second term. So it very much feels like an afterthought to his presidency.
After a short stop in the island nation of Cabo Verde off Africa's northwest coast, President Biden heads south to Angola. There, officials say he planned to focus on U.S. leadership on trade, investment, and infrastructure in Africa. He'll also recognize Angola's president, João Lourenço's regional leadership and global partnership on trade, security, and health. More importantly, President Biden will highlight one of his signature initiatives, the investment of the Lobito Corridor, a regional railway project linking natural resource-rich areas stretching from the Angolan port of Lobito to the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia. The corridor is part of a wider joint effort between multiple partners aimed at closing the infrastructure gap in growing economies around the world, officials say. Dr. Francis Brown, Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for African Affairs at the National Security Council, speaking about the broader benefits associated with the project.
What I found really notable about the Lobito Corridor is that it isn't just about a railroad or critical minerals. It's also about the communities that are strengthened along the way. It's about more access to education. It's about agricultural products moving to market. And it's about increases in digital connectivity.
Last year, U.S.-Angola trade totaled approximately $1.77 billion, making Angola America's fourth largest trade partner in sub-Saharan Africa. Angola has vast mineral deposits and is Africa's third largest oil producer. But according to Amnesty International, the country's natural resource wealth has not translated to prosperity for most of its people, resulting in numerous peaceful protests against poverty, unemployment, and high cost of living. Nell says some Angolans may see a benefit with this Biden visit.
Many ordinary Angolans will recognize that Angola desperately needs to diversify its economy. And this is an enormous opportunity to do so, to move away from oil and gas and bolster other parts of the economy. So it has massive potential.
But others, including human rights campaigners and opposition parties, Nell says, will feel aggrieved by President Biden's visit because they see the Lourenço administration as being rewarded despite growing concerns about the shrinking space for independent civil society organizations and freedom of expression. In a new report, Amnesty International said that anyone who publicly criticizes the Lourenço government risks arrest, And, quote, if human rights are central to President Biden's foreign policy, then he must demand Angola's government immediately free arbitrarily detained government critics. Adriano Nuvunga, who runs the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Mozambique, echoes that sentiment.
I commend the people of Angola and President Lourenço for hosting President Biden. It means a lot for the people of Angola. While I commend them, I would also want to encourage President Biden to ask those tough questions to President João Lourenço. We have a number of human rights defenders in Angola that are detained unjustly, unfairly, for doing nothing. They are languishing in jail and some of them in critical condition.
Nuvunga hopes that this could be addressed during this trip. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Just before beginning his trip to Angola on Sunday, President Joe Biden pardoned his son Hunter, sparing the younger Biden a possible prison sentence for federal felony gun and tax convictions. The announcement reversed the president's past comments that he would not pardon his son after his convictions in the two cases in Delaware and California. The move comes as Hunter Biden was set to receive his sentences after his trial conviction in the gun case and guilty plea on tax charges, and less than 2 months before President-elect Donald Trump is set to return to the White House. The move sparked some controversy, with Trump calling it an abuse and miscarriage of justice. However, Eric Holder, the former U.S. Attorney General under Democratic President Barack Obama, said no U.S. attorney would have pursued the case against Hunter Biden if he were not related to the president. Just before President Biden headed to Angola, VOA's Peter Cloete spoke with Angolan Foreign Minister Tete Antonio about a range of issues concerning Angola's role in Africa. In this excerpt of their conversation, they discussed the Angolan government's goals for next year when it holds the chair in the African Union. Antonio told Peter the main goal will be enhancing peace and security on the continent.
And Angola, we would like to see also Africa look at its conflict as we have been doing, maybe do better. And not only Africa, but without forgetting the responsibility of the United Nations, I mean the Security Council, who has the primary responsibility for peace and security in the world. We happy that the resolution to fund the peace operation, peace support operation. This is the language used in Africa. We don't use peacekeeping operation. Peace support operations deployed by the African Union can be funded with 75%. But the responsibility is ours. So what is Angola will do is to make sure that both mechanisms are working. And second, to make sure that Africans talk. Africa talk, our philosophy to promote dialogue is not going to be still on the table. It's going to be, we can talk among us and find a solution to the problems.
That was Angolan Foreign Minister Tete Antonio, who spoke with my colleague Peter Cloete on Saturday. You can find more news about Biden's visit to Angola on voaafrica.com and on voanews.com. You can keep up our reporting on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Drone strikes by Mali's military government killed 8 Tuareg rebel leaders in the town of Tinzaoutein in the north of the country. In a statement, separatists gave the names of the killed Tuareg chiefs, the best known of whom is Fahad Ag al-Mahmoud, secretary general of the Gatia armed group. Later Sunday evening, the general staff of the Malian armed forces confirmed the deaths in what the government called a special operation. The attack by Mali's military government comes a day after the armed groups in the north announced they were merging into a single political military entity called the Azawad Liberation Front. As communities around the globe commemorate World AIDS Day in Kenya, one health facility provides affordable care to everyone, especially communities of people living with HIV. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Outside the Coptic Hope Center for Infectious Diseases in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, scores of people wait patiently inside a small tent. The center, which began as a small clinic of the Coptic Hospital in Kenya in early 2004, offers subsidized HIV clinical care and treatment. Eva Mwangela is the center's program manager.
The program takes care of HIV-infected patients and clients. This program was started because of the need that was seen in the 1990s, and therefore they brought in the need of healthcare, providing free HIV testing, care and treatment for the infected clients, preventive services for those who are negative as well, and being able to handle community stigma and prevention in the communities around Nairobi.
The Hope Center has since expanded into a fully comprehensive HIV care and treatment program. It provides care to more than 55,000 people infected with HIV, with thousands receiving antiretroviral drugs or ARVs across Kenya, Zambia, Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, and Tanzania.
The program takes care of everyone in the community. We have the adults, we have pediatric, those are children, and we have youth. So we have three cohorts of clients, and therefore entirely taking care of a community. For adults, we have both, of course, men and women. For youth, the same. Inside the program, we have another program that entirely deals with pediatric. We emphasize on pediatric and prevention of mother-to-child transmission. We look at expectant mothers and their children as well.
The Coptic Orthodox Church Mission in Kenya runs the Hope Center with funding from the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR. Republican President George W. Bush announced PEPFAR to combat global HIV/AIDS in 2003. 18-year-old Stacy Akinyi is a mother living with HIV in Nairobi. She receives treatment from the Coptic Hope Center.
I got to know that I was HIV positive when I was in class 3. Every time my mom was giving me medicine, and I wasn't sick, so I was curious. When I asked her, it took her time, but she took me to the clinic that I was going to. We talked to the counselor. From there is when she broke to me that I'm HIV positive. At first, it didn't seem like a big deal, but from the stories in the textbooks, I was worried. I was thinking that I was going to die.
For years, HIV/AIDS was a life-threatening condition, but now Akinyi says people can manage HIV as a chronic health condition as long as they seek treatment with ARVs.
After a few counseling sessions, I got to accept, and as long as I can take my medication well, I can live just like any other normal person.
She says when she became pregnant, she was referred to the Coptic Hope Center.
I wanted to make sure that my daughter would come out negative. Growing up, I had that stigma for my friends and even some close relatives. I didn't want her to go through the same. I'm happy that the test that has been taken from my baby so far are all negative.
Under this year's World AIDS Day theme, My Health, My Right, the World Health Organization calls on everyone around the world to champion the right to health by addressing the inequalities that hinder progress in ending AIDS. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. Every Wednesdays, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. East African heads of states have made another push for peace in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, but the Associated Press reports the prospects remain bleak following a regional summit that was marked by the DRC president's absence and the early departure of his Rwandan counterpart. A communique read at the end of the closed-door meeting of the East African community in Arusha, Tanzania, only stated the need to combine regional and broader peace initiatives for sustainable peace in eastern DRC. The new head of the EAC summit, Kenyan President William Ruto, said the group's focus should be on increasing competitiveness, promoting value-added production, and boosting intra-regional trade to create jobs and transform member state economies. In a November interview, Morocco's foreign minister said his country plans to bring Central Sahel countries like Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali out of isolation with a joint development and port access package known as the Atlantic Initiative. As they battle militants linked to terror groups, Central Sahel countries have turned away from regional and international partners. So what can their neighbors do to reach out to them? Henry Wilkins reports.
Central Sahel countries Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger are continuing their fight against militant groups which has spread instability across the region. In the last 2 years, they have cut ties with France and the United States, which gave military assistance, and the West African political bloc ECOWAS, which includes many of their closest trading partners. The Central Sahel's military juntas said all three were a hindrance in their efforts to defeat the militants. In a November interview, Morocco's foreign minister said the country is attempting to break the region out of isolation. Bakary Sambe is the regional director of the Timbuktu Institute.
The launch of this Atlantic initiative, which aims to connect coastal countries and provide the Sahel nations with Atlantic access, is part of Morocco's plan to leverage its historical ties as well as strategic interests.
Ses liens historiques, mais aussi ses intérêts stratégiques.
Paul Melly, a consulting fellow for Chatham House, says that although Morocco is a significant economic force and has a strategic interest in regional stability in West Africa, its geographical position may make the initiative difficult.
The economics of using Moroccan ports, you know, you either go round through Mauritania, in which case it's an incredibly wrong way, or else you go across the Sahara. I think it would mean going through Mauritania, at which point, you know, it's geographically a very long way round.
Melly points out that security conditions make the Sahara route dangerous. Despite chilly relations, the landlocked Central Sahel countries still rely heavily on bordering coastal nations like Senegal, Benin, Ghana, Togo and Ivory Coast for port access. Sambe of the Mali-based Timbuktu Institute says cultural diplomacy may be more effective.
Morocco can still play a role in preventing violent extremism and combating terrorism by training imams and promoting a tolerant version of Islam as an alternative to religious extremism.
Sambe urged the coastal states to take a long-term view of relations and bear in mind that military juntas are likely a passing phase in the region's history. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
And in Guinea-Conakry, dozens of people were killed during Sunday's stadium stampede in the town of Nzarikori in southeast Guinea. The stampede occurred during a football final competing for a cup bearing the name of the military leader General Mamadi Doumbouya. Scores of others were hospitalized with injuries. And in our sports program, we have in studio sports analyst Mokbil Ebaro. Thank you for being here, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Yehez.
So let's go right into the football news. And the English Premier League was on fire this weekend. Let us talk about some of the biggest games.
Absolutely, Yehez. If we're just going to start it off, the biggest game had to have been Liverpool versus Manchester City. This was the number one team versus the number two slotted team. Manchester City having won 6 Premier League titles in X amount of years that Pep Guardiola has been there. They have won 4 straight now, and Liverpool alongside Arsenal have been the closest contenders to them in the last few years, with Liverpool having won during the COVID year season. Now, with that being said, so much anticipation. If Manchester City wins this game, they get within 5 points. If they lose, now the gap for them just drops down exponentially, goes down to 11 points. So fortunately for them, they were not able to get the job done. Liverpool wins comfortably 2-0 against Man City. Really should have been a bigger scoreline for them. They may have felt as though they could have won maybe 3 or 4-0. Manchester City is on a 6 or 7 game losing streak. This is the worst losing streak of Pep Guardiola's career as a manager in total. Not only for Manchester City, but also for his stint in Barcelona and Bayern Munich as well. It's been a very, very tough time. We'll see how they get out of it. Chelsea, who are currently tied for second place with Arsenal, had a 3-0 win against Aston Villa. Aston Villa is currently in the 12th spot. They are currently struggling. This is a team that finished top 4 last year. So hopefully they get it together as well. But Chelsea is playing really, really well. Arsenal also had a comfortable win over the weekend, 5-2 against West Ham. Really should have been 5, but you know, West Ham really some 2 quick goals back to back, and Arsenal kind of had to respond. But yeah, those were the games I would say over the weekend. Yes, here's the interesting thing: prior to last season, coming into it, they were really talking about this maybe potentially being his last season. He also has the Ballon d'Or winner, Rodri, goes out injured for an ACL tear for the entirety of the season. And really, that kind of changed the trajectory of this team, right? You have a player who plays in that central defensive midfield who allows the attacker players to be very comfortable because he plays such a protective role in the back line. Mm-hmm. He's out. It really changed what the team almost looks like, unfortunately, a shell of themselves.
Another venue, the WNBA numbers skyrocketed this year due to Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese. 2 rookies. Can they keep up with it?
Oh, yes. I think this is the most exciting the WNBA has been in a really long time. Kudos to, as you just mentioned, Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, 2 rookies that really allowed the women's basketball game to develop when they were both in college. One was at Iowa and the other one was at LSU. So that level of rivalry going from the collegiate game to the WNBA has allowed for more eyes to be on the game. And I think it's only getting better. You have a young player right now who plays for USC by the name of Juju Watt, who already has signed what they have said is a bigger Nike deal than Caitlin Clark, and she's only in college. So it's showing that there's been a lot of interest in the women's game. So only moving forward, it's only going to get better for the girls.
And staying with basketball, any standout games over the weekend?
I would say outside of the games, the most impressive team to me still, I feel like week in and week out, we're talking about the same team continually, the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Cavaliers have, for whatever reason, been able to put together a collective effort of, between Donovan Mitchell and Garland, they've been able to put together an 18-3. So they've won 18 games and only lost 3 games. 3 games that they've lost, 1 to the Boston Celtics and 2 to the Atlanta Hawks. Now, the Atlanta Hawks are a funny team in that they've been able to beat the hottest team twice, but have also lost to the Washington Wizards. And the Wizards are at the very bottom, at the very bottom of the Eastern Conference at the moment, currently with only 2 wins and 16 losses, Yehez.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Thank you, Mokbeel. I'm Yehez Wahib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.